Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
I'm Will Campion and co-founder of the Money Maze podcast, and we're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is also a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
I'd like to start with a story. It's Egypt, 1956. Suez crisis has taken place and Egyptian nationalism is on the rise. Greeks, Italians, Belgians, British are forced to flee the country and Egyptian Jews are expelled or imprisoned and accused of being Zionist agents. These refugees are forced to sign declarations donating their property to the government and only allowed to take one suitcase and 10 Egyptian pounds. Everything else they own is confiscated. One such refugee is an 11-year-old boy, and he boards a plane set for England and with his parents arrives in an alien country, not even speaking the language. Armed only with ambition and hope and hard work, he gets into grammar school, wins a scholarship to Oxford and then to Harvard Business School, and moves on to build one of the largest venture capital and private equity firms in the world, Apax. And over the last 20 years, he has been invited to advise governments, chaired the G8 Task Force for Impact Investment, helping drive the revolution to rethink the way we invest. And during all of this, he's authored 3 books, the most recent, Impact, which has just been released. Meanwhile, he has sat on the University of Oxford Investment Committee, been a member of the Board of Dean's Advisors at Harvard Business School, and Vice Chairman of Ben-Gurion University. His list of achievements could take up more of this podcast, so with his story still far from over, I'm thrilled to welcome as my guest today, Sir Ronald Cohen.
Hello, Simon. Pleasure to be here with you.
I'd like to start with the early days. I'm intrigued. What goes on in a child's mind when their world is torn apart and they land on the shores of an alien country?
My parents handled it in a very interesting way in retrospect because they made everything look like a wonderful challenge. We arrived in Britain, a new country, of course, the much more developed than Egypt was, or London incomparably bigger than Cairo. And it was all exciting. And then learning a new language. And I remember my mother baked a chocolate cake as soon as we moved into our rented apartment to make us feel that the home was the same as it had been in Cairo. And so I think just an exciting challenge is the way that it was presented to me. And that's how I accepted it.
And you attend 2 of the world's finest academic institutions, Oxford and then Harvard Business School. And I'm intrigued, how did they each equip you and differ for your subsequent journey?
Well, first, I have to say, Simon, that I feel a huge debt of gratitude for the help that I got to be able to go to Oxford with my education paid for by the state to get a scholarship to pay for my first year at Harvard. Were really very important moments in my life. Now, how did the two institutions differ? I think while I was at Harvard Business School, I realized that I had learned to think at Oxford, and that at Harvard Business School, I was learning a trade, if you like. In my particular case, it ended up being the trade of business and finance and venture capital.
And so let's turn to your career and specifically to venture capital. You've been described as the father of British venture capital and of social investment, which we'll return to, but you co-found Apax at only 26 years old, initially a VC firm, and it's been written that you had to create the industry in order to create the firm. And I wonder whether you can flesh that out, please.
I think what's exciting about entering a new field, and venture capital was non-existent in Europe when we got going in 1972, is that you do have to build the field. So you have to proselytize for it, you have to explain it, you have to bring examples of how it's worked in the United States and why it should work in Britain. And then you pretty quickly realize that that gives you a fantastic opportunity. It gives you the opportunity to become a leader of the field because you got into it ahead of others. You're building up experience ahead of others. You're building up your team ahead of others. And so you end up building up your firm and the field at the same time.
And is it fair to say that it was pretty hard going for a while? And whilst in the 1990s, deals that Apax did around autonomy and Yale and others occurred, there must have been a time that you wondered about this route you'd taken.
The first 10 years, I would say, from 72 to 81, were the most difficult years. 81 was the year in which we raised our first venture capital fund. Up until then, we were basically funding deals on a client basis, raising money for different companies and advising companies on their international expansion. In 1981, with the establishment of our first venture capital fund, the biggest in Europe at that time, together with that launched by Advent, £10 million. It seems like a puny amount today, but it seemed huge at the time. Today, it compares with €11 billion as the largest fund Apax has raised. So the years leading up to the establishment of the first venture capital fund were the most difficult. After that, we had to establish the track record, and I suppose you could say that took another 10 years. And from £10 million in 1981, by about 1991, we were raising over $1 billion for a fund.
And how did you stay positive when the going was getting tough?
I learned very quickly that there were two key questions I had to ask myself as I went through these periods of high uncertainty. The first is, do I believe I'm on the right path? And that this really related to, is venture capital going to become big? And if it is, then I know I have to persevere on the path. And the second question is, am I progressing in the right way? Am I doing the right things to become a leader of this new industry? And there we had to change strategy.
So I'd like to dive into the world of private equity some more. Malcolm Offord, who was a partner at Charterhouse and chairman of Badenoch, raised the question of what's the optimal ownership model? Is it a long-term hold like Warren Buffett or the five-year buy, hold, sell more like Henry Kravis?
So there are different horses and courses. In the case of Warren Buffett, he has a public vehicle and he has no need to show results along the way by selling companies because his share price reflects a shareholder's appreciation of his likely performance. The venture capital model started at a time when you couldn't possibly have had a public venture capital firm. Today, you have many public private equity firms. And so I think you're beginning to see now a shift of some of these firms to evergreen ways of investing. Some have done it by acquiring insurance companies and using their portfolios to make investments. Others have set up evergreen vehicles. I think there are horses for courses, but from the point of view of investors, having the ability to see a portfolio liquidated really gives you the proof of the pudding that returns were actually delivered.
So just staying with that for a second, you don't worry, therefore, that the Anglo-Saxon model that's evolved around PE, which is almost the antithesis of the German model, which is much more long-term investment and R&D. You don't think that we are disadvantaging ourselves by the importance it's come as a percentage of economic activity?
It's a tough judgment, but I would say that on balance, we have not disadvantaged ourselves. What has happened, which is rather odd, is that an increasing number of transactions is between venture capital firms and their funds. So if you have to liquidate an investment in a company because your fund is coming to the end of your life and it still has a lot of potential, another venture capital firm's fund will acquire it from you. And a big percentage of transactions is within the private equity industry for this reason.
I was intrigued. John Authors, who's an economic commentator who writes something called Points of Return on Bloomberg, at the end of July wrote quite an interesting analysis rebutting the criticisms of PE and concluding that in the industry's bad image is undeserved. Is there one deal that stands out in your time at Apax that you look back on with particular pleasure?
So many investments come to mind, but one particular one is Autonomy. Autonomy was a striking success because we backed the Mike Lynch when the company was tiny, less than £2 million of sales, and selling software to police forces that enabled them to recognize number plates. And we realized that the potential of this in the growing internet field, and the company, of course, delivered huge success for Apax funds, delivering $750 million worth of profit on about $3 million of investment. But another one that stands out is the investment in the company that cloned Dolly the sheep, where we lost the whole of our investment, but the company made it to the 100 most significant companies of the 20th century.
So let's talk a little bit about entrepreneurship. Your first book, published in 2007, was called The Second Bounce of the Ball, Turning Risk into Opportunity. And possibly jobs and job creation has never been more important than it's going to be in the post-COVID world. And for reference, small and medium-sized enterprises in the UK account for around 60% of UK private sector employment, or half of the turnover of the UK private sector. And what were the two things you would advise Rishi Sunak to do to help entrepreneurship in the UK?
Well, there's no doubt we're going to have to create new companies to fund the growth of small companies in the period of COVID and beyond. Many companies are going bust. Big companies are laying off people and they're unlikely to recruit them back. And so one thing I believe the Chancellor should do is to provide huge incentives now for investment in small and medium enterprises and in growth businesses. Another is the use of impact investment to address the most vulnerable in our society. Our government is going to emerge from this crisis laden with debt at a time when social issues grow in magnitude in massive ways. We're already beginning in many countries as a result of the high unemployment to see surges in homelessness, for example. And single-parent families are going to have a hard time. Elderly, unemployed people who find it difficult to get back into a job, their families are going to have a hard time. And so it's very important that incentives exist to provide investment to charitable organizations dealing with the most vulnerable. And so by providing incentives for that, providing incentives for investment in social impact bonds, for investment in loans to charitable organizations, is crucially important.
So we're going to come back to impact investing a little later on. But going back, I'm going to quote a few lines from your book, which was the advice is go for the largest opportunity in the largest market. Don't be afraid to recruit people who are better than you. Get an accurate measure of the financial runway you will need to take off. And at stage one, raise enough money for stage three. And I wonder, 13 years on, if there's anything you'd add to that advice.
Yes, with my thinking evolving around the need to deliver both profit and measurable impact, I would add to that, identify a social problem that you're passionate about solving and create a business model that enables you to build a unicorn, if that's what you want to do, that improves the lives of a billion people. The name of the game is changing now. It's shifting from delivering risk and return to delivering risk and return and impact.
Adam Smith, in his book Wealth of Nations, famously introduced the invisible hand of the markets. But as you pointed out, his first book was The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was about empathy and altruism. So I'd like to talk about this intersection, because I suppose I'll start with an admission. I started my professional investing career in the mid-80s and was taught about, in essence, maximizing risk-adjusted returns. And so I was initially skeptical of the idea of impact investing, not because of its motivation, but for its potential to negatively affect returns. I guess, in essence, profit and good, at times uneasy bedfellows. And I wonder how you had this Damascene conversion quite a few years ago. I'd love to hear about how that came about.
So it really started when the Treasury asked me in 2000 to lead a task force called the Social Investment Task Force to look at how government has been dealing with the issues of poverty and all the consequences of poverty with a more entrepreneurial eye, as they put it. And I realized then, and we talked about it in our report at the end of 2000, that we'd been very imaginative in finding ways of bringing investment capital to people who want to make money. We hadn't really put any effort into devising ways of bringing investment capital to those who want to improve other people's lives or the environment. And so the idea that it was possible to bring investment in that way set me off on the path of impact investment. 10 years later, we invented the security we'd been looking for, which was a social impact bond, where the return depends on a social improvement. In the case of the Peterborough bond, it had to do with the return depending on a reduction in the level of recidivism among prisoners leaving Peterborough jail. And then with the passage of time, Simon, I began to realize that this was a security that optimized risk, return, and impact, and that we could do the same with the whole of our economy.
Can you maybe just go back to that Peterborough scheme, because it was so important as a watershed? Could you explain it so we can all understand exactly what happened?
So you're all aware on this podcast that prisoners go back to prison very frequently. More than 60% of young prisoners go back to prison across the world within 18 months. And we wanted to address that issue, and we wanted to do it in a way that was more effective than just giving grants to charitable organizations. We wanted to give them investment capital. So we went to the Ministry of Finance, and we offered to provide £5 million from a group of investors to fund the charitable organizations that were helping prisoners stay out of jail after their release. And the deal we struck with the government was that below 7.5% reduction, the money wouldn't be paid back. It would be viewed as a philanthropic donation. But if we achieved more than a 7.5% reduction, the government would pay back the £5 million of capital and an annual return that would increase according to the level of success. In the event, we reduced the number of prisoners going back to jail by 9.7%, and investors got their £5 million back, together with a 3.1% annual return.
You've made a really interesting point about the need for measuring impact alongside reward. And you've also made the point that last century we didn't measure risk, and it was only, I think, after 1929 that GAAP, the generally accepted accounting principles, were embodied in US sort of corporate activities. Could you talk a little bit about the passage now and the mirror image, perhaps, of what we're seeing today?
Yes, I think we're at a similar crossroad to 1929 in the sense that in 29 there was no transparency on the profit companies were making. Now, this may seem very odd today, but in those days, every company could pick its own accounting principles. There were no auditors to verify the numbers. And companies could put money out of their profit into a hidden reserve that they didn't even tell investors about, which seems extraordinarily intransparent in today's terms. There were recriminations at the time that this would spell the end of generally accepted accounting principles and auditors and so on, would spell the end of American capitalism. Of course, we know it led to the deepening and broadening of, and sophistication of financial markets. Now, today, we're in a similar position with regard to transparency on the impact that companies create. We have $30 trillion of ESG investing and another trillion of impact investment, where the impact is actually measured in contrast to ESG, which represent together more than a third of professionally managed financial assets in the world. And yet there's no transparency on the impact that is being created by companies. And so I'm saying that as we, as the US did, should I say, in 1933 in mandating generally accepted accounting principles, we now need to mandate generally accepted impact principles and mandate that companies, starting 2 years from now, begin to publish accounts that reflect their impact as well as their profit.
And you've been doing work with Harvard Business School on these impact-weighted accounts. And would you say that it's the US that's leading this, or the UK, US, and other countries are all sort of together in this mission?
Well, the first thing is that it is made possible, Simon, because of computing power and big data. You can now go to the Harvard Business School website and look for impact-weighted accounts, and you can access data set that shows you the environmental damage and the cost of the environmental damage created by 1,800 companies. And next year, we will be adding to that employment impact and the employment from the operations of companies on the environment and on people. So technology makes it possible for us today to have a comprehensive view of the impacts created by companies. Now, in terms of the development of these ideas, the ideas have moved forward faster in Europe than they have in the United States, even though this is an example of the US building up the field. Europe has been more attuned to issues of climate, particularly with the arrival of the Trump administration. The US has been held back, really, from playing a big role in addressing climate change. And so it may be that these new impact-weighted accounts that you will see described on the Harvard Business School site will be adopted earlier by companies and investors in Europe than they will in the US or elsewhere.
So I'd like to talk about some real life examples. You might describe the good, the bad, and the ugly to illustrate this. I think you've done work on Sasol, the South African energy company, Solvay, the Belgian chemical company, and Intel, the best-in-class chip maker. And I wonder, what were your findings?
So what emerged from the data was very striking. Within the chemicals industry, Sasol delivers 17 billion of environmental damage a year, $17 billion, that is, relative to sales of $12 billion. Solvay, a European-based company, delivers $3.7 billion on sales of $12 billion. And a company like BASF, which is more than five times the size, with $70 billion of sales, is delivering $7.7 billion of damage. So huge variation in the impact performance of companies within the same sector.
It's been said that COVID-19 might actually be an accelerator, but I wasn't sure when I tried to understand is why that might be happening.
COVID-19 is an accelerator potentially, two big changes, like the adoption of impact-weighted accounts and certainly to the flow of impact investment, for two major reasons. The first is it's shaking our habits and our beliefs. We begin to see capitalism questioned in ways that we haven't seen for many years, and sometimes even democracy is questioned. At the same time, we're aware that there were glaring inequalities going into COVID, and that COVID is going to exacerbate these inequalities. So the stability of our societies is going to be threatened in a very significant way if we don't have a just recovery. And then, because of the importance of climate and the effects we're seeing across the world of climate change, there's a similar sense of urgency around climate. So something like impact investment and impact weighted accounts that enable us to make it through the recovery sooner, but also to prepare our system so that it can begin to deliver positive solutions to the problems we face, rather than continuing to dig a deeper and deeper hole for ourselves with problems of society and the environment, becomes a major priority.
So in your book, Impact, you outline 9 things governments should do to turbocharge change. Now, I think we all know about government's inability to get stuff done and that governments are typically unhelpful in their business interventions. I think it was Ronald Reagan who said, if it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And if it stops moving, subsidize it. But what are the 2 things you think government must and can do above all else?
Well, the most important thing is to mandate the adoption of transparency on impact, and therefore the publication of impact-weighted accounts by companies to achieve this transparency. That is capable of reshaping capitalism, bringing impact and profit, measurable impact and profit, to drive our economic system, will prevent companies from doing huge harm, which governments then have to tax us all in efforts to remedy it. It will also create a race to the top where companies are judged according to both their profit and their impact performance, and their stock market valuations reflect this. So that is the big thing. But there are simpler things that need to be done immediately. The first is we need to encourage the flow and incentivize the flow of capital to small and medium-sized businesses, as well as entrepreneurially led growth businesses, to absorb the unemployment, as we've said. We also need to provide incentives to provide funding to charitable organizations that are helping the most vulnerable. If we don't do that, we will not have a recovery that is judged to be fair. So I think it's very important for the Chancellor to bear both of these immediate actions and this longer-term effect of changing the drivers of our economic system from profit alone to profit and impact.
So in your book, you devote a chapter to philanthropy, and you raise an interesting point, which is that the endowment's aim is to maximize returns, but there, of course, the donor's aim is to maximize good. And I wonder how you think that potential conflict is reconciled.
So the conflict has been there for a century, and it's time that we resolved it in an intelligent way. It's self-defeating to have an endowment invest in companies that pollute, then with your grants to fund companies that are fighting pollution. To get beyond that, you have to begin to direct your investments to ESG and to impact investment. And the Ford Foundation has done that. It's directed $1 billion out of its $14 billion endowment in that direction. But I think the model in the future will be accepted that you can have your mission achieved by your endowment, by your balance sheet, in the same way that you're trying to achieve it through your grants, that you can exclude certain areas of investment which you disagree with, investment in tobacco, investment in fossil fuels are obvious examples, and still achieve acceptable levels of return. It doesn't make sense to create harm with 95% of your assets and try to create good with 5% from the return that you've got from those assets.
Well, that, of course, leads us into asset allocation. We had Tony Dorward, the chief executive of Gresham House, on the show, and he was referring to a Mercer study that 25% of UK pension fund allocations are now in alternative assets in real estate. Now, the impact component of that, I suspect, is negligible at the moment. How should and how can investors access this area?
So, interestingly, within alternative assets is where impact investment started. Impact venture capital, impact private equity, impact property, impact infrastructure is where all this started, making investments that can deliver market rates of return and measurable impact at the same time. ESG is obviously directed primarily at public companies. And the equities that you hold in public companies and the bonds that you hold is the bulk of the ESG flow today. And there, what we lack is the transparency we were talking about, the transparency on the impact that these companies create. But the intention to move away from companies delivering harm to companies that don't deliver harm and hopefully also do some good is very clearly expressed now by the 30 trillion plus that's going to ESG and impact investment. That is way beyond tipping point, Simon. That is the direction of the future. And that's why Peter Harrison of Schroders calls impact a mega trend.
Yes, absolutely. And he talked about that when he was on the show and their own vehicle, Blue Orchard. And I note your own firm, Bridges Ventures, has achieved some absolutely terrific returns over a decade. So it does provide great and unambiguous ammunition to those who remain skeptical. I'd like to turn the conversation to some broader topics. And some of our guests have said that despite their own generosity, they find themselves sort of criticized often for what they haven't done rather than what they have done. And I wondered how you think about this dilemma for people who are wanting to do good and being very generous.
So we have a strange system today, and the contradictions sit very uneasily with the general public. We have a system where you devote your career to making money, and then having made money, you give some money away in order to improve lives, help medical research, and prevent environmental damage or whatever. The contradiction is not lost on people. And what impact investment is saying is, look, the two can be consistent. You can do good and do well during your whole career. And you can continue to be philanthropic beyond it by both giving money away and investing the resources that you've created in a way that delivers both impact and profit. And that's what I have tried to do.
In speaking about advice to youngsters, I'm quoting you from your book, you choose a problem that affects a large number of people and define a product or service that solves it. I mean, that sounds possibly too easy. Can you just unpick that a bit?
Each of us is moved by a particular set of issues that affect people and planet. So I'd like to give you the example of a very successful entrepreneur in Israel in the driverless car area who sold the company he co-founded for $15 billion to Intel. He had a desire to help the blind. His aunt was going blind, and she asked him for help, and he was keen to find a product that enabled the blind, in inverted commas, to see. Coming out of the artificial intelligence area, he could build his expertise to deliver a pair of spectacles which have a device like a memory stick hanging on the side that whispers into the ear of the wearer the page of the book they're holding, or the banknote they're holding. The page is read totally professionally. It can even translate from one language to another. And so clearly of great value for the 35 million blind people in the world, enabling them to lead more or less a normal life in many more respects. But if you begin to think with an impact hat on, then you ask yourself the question, how could this technology help the maximum number of people in the world? And you come back with a very surprising answer. The answer is, what if you gave this device to the 800 million illiterate adults in the world? How would that affect their lives and livelihood? Their economies and even the world economy to bring 800 million people from not reading to reading. And so I hope, Simon, this illustrates how you can do good and do well at the same time.
And if you had your time again, would you have done anything differently?
We tried at Apex to invest in an impactful way. We did not invest in tobacco or in alcohol or in gambling or in defense from our very first days. If I were 26 today, I would be getting into impact venture capital and impact private equity. I might even be getting into impact management of public stocks and bonds.
So a couple of different questions, if I may. You're obviously involved in lots of different things. How do you switch off and what's the perfect day for you?
I'm going from morning to night and through weekends, basically developing efforts to bring impact investment to scale and to bring impact to the center of our economies. I still find time to walk along the beach here in Tel Aviv in the mornings or evenings, to go swimming, to row in the gym, to read books, to listen to music, to be with my family.
And if you were to recommend your favorite book and your favorite film, what might they be?
One of my favorite books is called The Bridge of San Luis Rey by Thornton Wilder. It was written in the 30s. It's a slim book, beautifully written, and it describes a 600-year-old bridge that falls apart one day with certain people walking on it, and it tries to analyze why this happened to them specifically. And there's something liberating about reading that book.
If you could only watch one more film again.
I think Some Like It Hot, which is an oldie. There are plenty since then, but I thought that was really great film.
I think this has been an extraordinary conversation. You wrote, you can't learn to swim by doing exercises on the beach. And that's exactly what you've been doing with Impact. I also read that you want your legacy to be one of inspiring and helping others. And I think you've absolutely done that and are doing that. So it's been a great privilege for me to talk to you today, Sir Ronald. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.